This is Susan Sarandon for Mumia Abu-Jamal. It has been barely a week since I departed death row, yet I cannot help but look back, for many of you are in my heart. I may no longer be on death row, but because of you, death row is still with me. How could that not be so, when I have spent more years of my life on death row than in freedom, or more time spent on death row than with my family? I write to tell you all, even those I've never met, that I love you, for we have shared something exceedingly rare. I have shared tears and laughter with you that the world will neither know nor see. I have shared your anguish when some judge shattered your hopes and spit disappointment, or when some politician sought to use you to climb to higher office. We have seen time and disease take some of our people off the row. We have seen several choose their own date to die, cheating the hangman via suicide, like William Bill Tilly and Jose June Pagan. But, brothers and sisters of the row, I write not of death, but of life. If I can walk off, so can you. Keep rumbling, keep fighting, keep rocking, check out your mill's issue. But there is more. Live each day, each hour, as if it is the only time there is. Love fiercely. Learn a new thing, a language, an art, a science. Keep your mind alive. Keep your heart alive. Laugh. Look at each other not as competitors, but as fellow travelers on the same red road of life. No matter what the world says of you, see the best in each other and radiate love to each other. Be your best self. If you are blessed to have family, send your love to them all, no matter what. If you have a spiritual family or faith, practice it fully and deeply, for this links you to something greater than yourself. No matter what, Christian, Muslim, Judaism, Hindu, Krishna consciousness, Buddhism, or Santeria, or MOVE, this broadens you and deepens you. I have been blessed to have many of you as my teachers and my students. Some have been my sons. Some have been my brothers, yet I see all of you as part of my family. Take heart, for the death penalty itself is dying. States and counties simply can't afford it, and politicians who run on it are finding fewer and fewer buyers. Juries, especially in places like Philly, are increasingly reluctant to vote for death, even in cases where it appears imminent. Sisters on the row, while we have never met, my heart has felt your tears as you are forcibly separated from your children, unable to hold or kiss them. In many ways, as women, your anguish has been the worst, as your loves and sensitivities are deepest. My words to my brothers are yours as well. Keep mind alive. Keep hearts alive. Live, love, learn, laugh. I know you all as few outsiders do. I've met artists, musicians, mathematicians, managers, jailhouse lawyers, and stockbrokers. I've seen guys who couldn't draw a straight line emerge as master painters, like Cush and Young Buck. I've seen guys come from near illiteracy to become fluent in foreign languages. I've met teachers who've created works of surpassing beauty and craftsmanship, like Big Tony. You are all far more than others say of you, for the spark of the infinite glows within each of you. You are on death row, but what is finest in you is greater than death row. So care for each other, not in words, but in the heart. Think good vibes on each other, and lastly, don't rat. If ratting was so cool, they would have beaten me off the row. So keep rumbling, 'cause your day is coming. This is Susan Sarandon from Mumia Abu-Jamal. Prison and government officials are trying to censor and silence Mumia Abu-Jamal. I stand as one of many Americans who believe that there is tremendous value in his voice being heard.
The Fletcher Rule. I speak today of a man on death row, a man known to many as Two Guns. For many, perhaps most, the words death row and the nickname Two Guns are all that needs be said. For taken together, they paint a picture tinged with guilt. But this is not that case. Anthony Fletcher is his birth name, and his nickname was his boxing name. The guns, his fists, which took him to the brink of greatness in the ring, where he fought and bested great fighters like Boom Boom Mancini and Livingstone Bramble. Until 1993, when a Philadelphia jury convicted him of shooting a man whom Fletcher claimed was shot in self-defense. Under today's law, Fletcher would have been acquitted, if not charged at all, but this was 93. In 2004, a Philadelphia judge granted him a new trial after a pathologist admitted he gave erroneous testimony at his trial as to whether a struggle occurred. In most states, that would have been the end of it, but not in Pennsylvania. In 2007, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court threw out the new trial, used a dubious claim used at the original trial, false misleading testimony by medical examiner Dr. Ian Hood, and reversed the post-conviction judge, reinstating a first-degree murder conviction and a death sentence. Anthony Two Guns Fletcher was sent back to death row. If the mistaken pathologist and a crack-addled so-called witness hadn't presented false, misleading testimony in the first trial, there wouldn't even have been a conviction. But there you are. In Pennsylvania, self-defense isn't self-defense if they don't want it to be. In fact, jailhouse lawyers here think Two Guns got sent back to death row for the most greasy of reasons. He refused to plead guilty to third-degree murder, and thereby allowing the DA to keep an unjust, unreliable conviction. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Solitary confinement, especially for extended terms, is quite literally soul death, or the state's way of killing without killing. I've seen men mutilate themselves, cut their necks, their throats, all because the mind-killing boredom drove them out of their skulls. There's a reason the United Nations Special Rapporteur calls solitary a form of torture if one is held that way over a few weeks, because it is. That's why guys across California staged hunger strikes, as did men in Georgia and in Ohio, because solitary was killing them, and by starving themselves to death, they could determine their own destiny. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Children of the Whole. As the national fever of mass incarceration continues across America, every so often a break occurs. This was such a case from the unlikeliest of places, Mississippi. For there, quite recently, a U.S. federal court issued a consent decree banning the ignoble and barbarous practice of placing juveniles, children, in solitary confinement. The late March order, believed to be the first of its kind in the country, bans a system that consigned children to almost total isolation, the kind that has become virtually routine in U.S. adult prisons. This practice, used against children who were certified as adults, resulted in exacerbated mental illness, psychological breakdowns, and suicide attempts, which, oddly enough, resulted in even more repression. Under international law, solitary confinement can constitute torture. Imagine its impact on children. A joint suit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and Southern Poverty Law Center challenged these conditions in a November 2010 civil rights action against Mississippi's Walnut Grove Youth Correctional Facility, a private prison which holds males aged 13 to 22. The suit charged brutality, drug smuggling by guards, and sexual improprieties. The consent decree also bans juveniles from placement in that facility. What kind of country consigns its children to the horrors of solitary confinement? This kind. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. caging the young. Sometimes I'm shocked by the youth of some of the young men around me. I've met guys who have never heard of Chuck D, Carlos Santana, Jimi Hendrix, or Bob Marley. When I mention names like these, I can tell by their blank stares that they have no idea who these great musicians are or were. It's impossible to talk jazz with them. That's like rapping to them about lyres played by ancient Greeks. That's the side of the prison industrial complex that most people, even activists, don't see. Children in prison, so young that they don't shave, serving decades in prison with decades to go. Most are the human flotsam and jetsam of the drug wars, the illegitimate economy that flows in too many urban communities, and the raging fury that sparked the imprisonment boom that was and is the Rural Jobs Program for America. Enemies of the state at birth, given an abominable, punitive, empty education, a preamble to prison that trains children to accept metal detectors and little else, so that schools are but training grounds for prisons upstate. Only a movement can change this dire reality. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. The Other Side of Solitary. It was one of those days of rarity. A group of legislators held a public hearing on, of all things, solitary confinement in, of all places, Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, the state, indeed, the jurisdiction with the highest number of juveniles imprisoned for life than any other state in the United States and any other jurisdiction on earth. The state with thousands of people locked down in solitary confinement for years, for decades, for lifetimes. One such man is Russell Maroon Schultz, a man nearing his 72nd birthday, and who is also nearing almost 30 years in solitary, in the hole. His daughter, Teresa, a stalwart fighter for her father, has, with the rest of the family, fought for years for Maroon's release from such draconian conditions. When Teresa began her testimony, she broke the quiet, calm decorum in a way no one could have foreseen. She described growing up with her father, living in daily torturous conditions. Then she pulled a 5-gallon bag of prescription pills from her purse and cast it on the table. She told the lawmakers that if they wanted to see the effects of her battle for her father, they needed to look no farther than her remarkable bag of medications, all of which she needed to treat and manage her stress-related illnesses. Those present at the hearing said Teresa's presentation stunned people. Despite such a powerful human demonstration of the impact of state torture on loved ones, politicians alone are incapable of bringing change. There must be mass movements devoted to bringing an end to solitary confinement. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. A question of torture. Most public comment on the American practice of extended solitary confinement is but an expression of ignorance, for the commentators refer to something they have neither seen nor known. For tens of thousands of men, women, and juveniles, U.S. citizens all, they know this phenomenon as reality. For they awaken it, they dwell in it, and they fight the fires of hell in it. It is, after all, a political institution, initiated, maintained, and continued by a political institution, prison, and sanctioned by the highest political institutions of the state, legislatures, judges, and governors. It is the logical endpoint of decades of tough talk by pundits and politicians alike, who vie to be the toughest on crime. Lock them up. Throw away the key. From such frothy-mouthed malice has come the cold steel bricks of solitary confinement, where tens of thousands experience the daily, hourly, minute-by-minute reality of torture by social ostracism into the netherworld of isolation. What is most distressing is that this isn't new knowledge. When Philadelphia really was a Quaker city, and the local elites erected the first penitentiary to teach penitents in that city, they threw men into solitary cells of silence, accompanied only by a Bible. They learned rather quickly that such a regime drove men mad. They knew this 200 years ago. How have we forgotten this in the second half of the 20th century? The skunk in the room is the dismal art of politics and the dungeons of our present, where over 100,000 people dwell in never-ending hell. That's the grim result. For our politics is but an expression of our fear, and fear is the currency of our media. Racial fear, class fear. And where there is fear, there is hatred. And where hatred, violence. And what violence is greater than state violence? State violence built the world's biggest imprisonment machine, what scholars and activists call the prison industrial complex. And the solitary confinement regime is a subset of that complex. Now, the so-called tribunes of the people, the media, have announced what we've known for decades, that solitary is torture. You think? It was torture in the 1800s. It was torture in the 1970s. It's torture today, and it'll be torture tomorrow. It's torture for people like Russell Maroon Schultz, who, but for brief intervals, has spent nearly three decades in solitary. For thousands of men and women on death rows across America, for the many who have spent lifetimes in state-ordered loneliness, separated not just from loved ones, but from other prisoners for decades. Politics built these edifices of fear and ignorance. Only an enraged citizenry can bring them down. Now is the hour. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Attica, 41 years later. The name Attica has entered the lexicon of American culture, driven in part by the cinema performance in Dog Day Afternoon, when actor Al Pacino raised his fist and exclaimed, "Attica, Attica." Viewers immediately got the reference, for on September 9, 1971, Attica, a reference to the state prison in upstate New York, was the biggest news in the country. Prisoners demanded to be treated as men, and the state, under orders of then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller, unleashed a hail of bullets that killed dozens of men, prisoners and prison guards alike, and lied about it. Attica, politicians and prison reformers assured us, would be the harbinger of change. Never again, they said. This September marks 41 years since that day of carnage and mass death, and things have changed, but not for the better. According to a recent bulletin published by the New York State Prison Monitoring Group, the Correctional Association, Attica remains a place of violence, fear, sexual and racist abuse, and disrespect. As in 1971, the staff is overwhelmingly white, and the prisoners are overwhelmingly black and Latino. As in 1971, the joint is thick with tension. As in 1971, disrespect and mistreatment rolls down the hallways like dry tumbleweeds waiting to ignite. The Correctional Association has called for Attica to be shut down, as it remains a grim symbol of expensive, brutal failure. If it does, it'll be 41 years too late. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Art and incarceration. When we consider art and incarceration, this originally sounds like an oxymoron, a stunning incongruity. But in fact, these drab, colorless human storage boxes are bursting with art. For those with an eye to see, the arts are bursting through like sunlight on Easter morning. There is a stunning amount of talent hidden behind these walls, more than even I believed. We should not be surprised that many young men see themselves as rappers, for rap, hip-hop, is their dominant form. And if you mingle amongst men under 30, you'll hear the sing-song rhythms of rap songs, either repeating the work of someone in videos or someone's original composition. A rap is, well, rap. It is a truly democratic art form, and everyone thinks they're the next Biggie or the next Tupac, but that isn't all. I've seen men play piano keyboards with tenderness, grace, and immense talent. For some men, a keyboard is just an instrument for making beats, beds to rap over. Others play R&B standards, Stevie Wonder, The Temptations, and the like. And still others play songs of their own composition, works of considerable imagination, of sweetness and light. Some guys play for the prison chapel, accompanying sermons or gospel songs. That this incredible talent exists here is all the more remarkable because there is no music class here. Men either learn from other men or they simply teach themselves through trial and error or study from books. A story for you. There's a young man here who, like many men his age, loves music, although he's never studied it nor played an instrument. He's been told almost his whole life that he's learning disabled. As a consequence, he has difficulty reading. A few months ago, he acquired a keyboard. He produced 3 beats the first night. Within a few weeks, he and his cellmate recorded a song with a catchy hip-hop beat, but above it all, flowing in and about, was a remarkable jazz solo, the light, airy sound of a soprano saxophone. It wasn't just good, it was excellent, and it sounded like something you'd hear on the radio. I asked, "Who played that?" He answered, "I did." I asked, "How did you do that? Where did it come from?" He said, "I heard it." I asked, "What do you mean, heard it? On the radio?" He replied, "No, man, I heard it, like, in my head." I was stunned. And yet, incarceration unleashes hidden talents in those encaged. I've seen drawings in pencil or pen, paintings in watercolor or acrylic, even sculptures of truly amazing craft, skill, and vision, artworks that could proudly be exhibited in any gallery or museum in America made by prisoners, and poetry to make you wonder or weep. Hidden behind brick and steel, in shadowed cell, alone, in twilight, art lives. Art is that which makes us human. And in this place, in this most inhuman of places, art yet lives. Colorful, resplendent, original, magical echoes of creativity, and yet it lives. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
The world's warden. Some of us think of the issue of mass incarceration as a state problem, a national problem, or even a legal problem. The immense growth of the prison industrial complex is all of these things and more. It is a global problem, as we saw in Abu Ghraib, Iraq, when state prison guards, the most notorious of which hailed from Pennsylvania's prison in Greene County, CO Charles Grainer, who are also members of the U.S. Army Reserves. For there, the bulk of the torture and brutality against Iraqis was perpetrated by men and women who had civilian gigs in state prisons across America. Abu Ghraib almost singularly undermined the U.S. imperial mission in Iraq and erupted into scandal. To be sure, America is the biggest incarcerator on earth, and the greatest damage, therefore, is to fellow Americans who live half lives, where every option of social advancement is closed to them upon release, jobs, education, public housing, and social benefits. In modern-day America, a felony conviction is the latest version of the Scarlet Letter. It is the mark of Cain, meant to deter people from achievement and class ascent. Law professor Michelle Alexander argues that it is, as shown by the title of her recent book, The New Jim Crow. But it is more. for dead vast swaths of society, desensitizes them, so that this vast population of some 3 million people are out of sight, out of mind. They are today's non-persons, merely a commodity for an industry that grows by leaps and bounds, providing jobs and job security for white rural districts which have long ago lost their place in the realm of manufacturing. This is the terrible link that keeps this non-productive industry alive, economic interest. Years ago, such rural districts shunned and protested the placement of prisons in their midst. Now they beg for them. As manufacturers fled U.S. shores in search of ever lower labor costs after NAFTA's 1994 passage, prisons became the biggest growth industry, producing the prison industrial complex. It is this complex of misery that must be undone, and only a mass movement can achieve it. For home is where the hatred is. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
This is Mark Taylor of Educators for Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia's audio essay entitled Incarceration Nation was sent to me for my students at Princeton Theological Seminary in a class I teach on incarceration. He wrote it while in the hole, the restricted housing unit at State Correctional Institution Mahanoy. Before I knew he was going to be in the hole, I had invited him to phone in a spoken commentary to my class, as he had done on two other occasions. Once Mumia went into the hole, I expected to hear nothing. It is testimony to his indomitable spirit and political commitment, though, that Mumia got this five-page handwritten text and discerning analysis out to my class while in the hole. Then, on one of his first days out of the hole, he recorded the audio tape you were about to hear, only slightly altered from the handwritten text. I found this audio version in my online Dropbox as a surprise, he said. This was made possible also by the good efforts of Prison Radio's Noel Hanrahan. Again, this is Mark Lewis Taylor. Now enjoy this, another fine commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Incarceration Nation. Fellow students, Dr. Mark Lewis Taylor, I thank you all for this rare opportunity to join you, this time back on tape. For the first time in nearly three decades, I join you. For the first time, free from a death sentence. Yet, I write from the nation's only growing public housing population, its prisons. As Michelle Alexander, Angela Y. Davis, and a plethora of scholar activists have more than aptly demonstrated, we are in the throes of an imprisonment fever, holding millions of men, women, and children in shackles. It is what I call incarceration nation. As this is both an academic as well as a theological setting, I intend to share with you voices that may not necessarily be commonly heard or expressed here, but are vital to the mission of institutions such as these, as they arise from the very heart of black religious practice, albeit of various spiritual traditions. Indeed, the first is drawn from a uniquely artistic tradition, and is therefore a performance of a performance, so to speak. You'll understand more shortly, I bet. For the black preacher has been, since Africans arrived on these shores, the central voice of black yearning, black hope, and yes, black resistance to the system of white supremacy and racist terror against black life. Acclaimed black dialect poet Paul Lawrence Dunbar, in his 1896 poem, An Antebellum Sermon, brings out the soul and the satire inherent in black life and the traditions of the black preacher. Thus, we is gathered here, my brothers, in this howling wilderness, for to speak some words of comfort to each other in distress. Now, El Pharaoh, down in Egypt, was the worst man ever born, and he had the Hebrew chillin' down there wicking in his comb. So well, the Lord got tired of his fooling, and says he, I'll let him know. Look here, Moses, go down to Pharaoh and tell him to
let them children go. But for fear someone mistakes me, I will pause right here to say that I'm still a preaching ancient. I ain't talking about today. But I tell you, fellow Christians, things will happen mighty strange. Now the Lord done this for Israel, and his ways don't never change. And the love he showed to Israel wasn't all on Israel spent. Now don't run and tell your master that I was preaching discontent. Because I isn't. I was a judging Bible people by their acts. I was a giving you the scripture. I was a handing you the facts. Because old Pharaoh believed in slavery. But the Lord, he let him see that the people he put breath in, every mother's son was free. But when Moses, with his power, comes and sets us chilling free, we will praise the gracious master that has given us liberty. And we'll shout our hallelujahs and that mighty reckoning day when we recognize the citizen. Chilling. Let us pray. Paul Lawrence Dunbar, mined the rich motherlode of black speech and oration to fund his poetry. And while it may sound somewhat new to some students here, I assure you, as someone who accompanied his mother to a black Baptist church in his childhood, the rhythms and intonations of Dunbar are as familiar as an old relative. That said, it was penned over a century ago, and new deliveries, new attitudes, and even new religions were inevitable. By the 60s, voices such as Malcolm X's would ascend to the pulpit in the name of an American-born Islam, such as that of the Nation of Islam, which would use new rhythms and a different message to give voice to the black spirit. The following text is one of his sermons, and it's typical. My brothers and sisters, our slave masters, Christian religion, has taught us black people here in the wilderness of North America that we will sprout wings when we die and fly up into the sky where God will have for us a special place called heaven. This is white man's Christian religion used to brainwash us black people. We have accepted it. We have believed it. We have practiced it. And while we're doing all of that, for himself, this blue-eyed devil has twisted his Christianity to keep his foot on our backs, to keep our eyes fixed on the pie in the sky and heaven in the hereafter, while he enjoys his heaven right here on this earth in this life. Of course, the differences in tone, in structure, and even in language are, to say the least, striking. Yet both forms are reflections of the central concerns of black people: freedom, liberty, here, now. And it might also be said that both forms resulted in the frustration of hopes dashed, for in Dunbar's time, black people were experiencing the great betrayal of Reconstruction, where all the promises of the Constitution's 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were sacrificed on the altar of white supremacy and KKK terrorism, and ignored for most of the 20th century. In Malcolm's time, meanwhile, we were in the opening innings of the mass incarceration period, where, despite declining crime rates, prison populations with predominantly black incarcerees would literally rise tenfold between 1970 and the 90s. Little wonder that the tones would change until today, when we're in incarceration nation with millions behind bars. Malcolm knew something of this, for he did nearly a decade in prison, where he experienced his conversion to the Nation of Islam's teaching. I think that experience steeled him and made him the outstanding minister he would later become. It deepened and sharpened his critique. And yet, we're still an incarceration nation, the prison industrial complex, where prisons are America's sole remaining growth industry. I thank you. From Incarceration Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.